This is Jim Engster, and thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And our special guest to start is the incomparable James Carville, the best-known political consultant in the universe. And, of course, he hails from these parts, graduate of LSU a few times. And in 1992, on this date, November 3rd, his world changed. The campaign that he led for Bill Clinton ended with the presidency of the United States. Bill Clinton won the election 25 years ago tonight. James, I'm sure you remember that night at the old State House in Little Rock pretty well.
I remember it great. You know, there's an expression that when the night you win a presidential campaign, you get to breathe the most rarefied air on earth. It was a pretty remarkable night. You know, it's not, these things don't happen to a small number of people, and it was really fun that night.
Well, looking back on it, Bill Clinton's election was in many ways as improbable as Donald Trump's. He was a 46-year-old governor from a small state, and of course, as we know, he had some controversy, which you helped navigate the course. He survives a few different revelations, but he stayed in there through thick and thin. Many others would have quit the campaign long before, but he stayed the course. And at any point, did you have any doubt that he was in the game?
You know, not really. I mean, you're in it, and it's just like it's akin to, I guess, like being in a sports contest in the World Series, or you know, football game. I mean, all you're worried about is the next play. I mean, I'm thinking about quitting at any point. And you know, it was pretty clear into the process that he was far and away the most talented person on the Democratic side, for sure. And I think, you know, you could sense that voters were starting to recognize that. And so, no, I never really thought about at any point quitting anything.
Well, in early...
You don't get to that point in your life and think about quitting.
No, but as we know, Gary Hart did quit in 1988 when he was accused of having an extramarital liaison. Bill Clinton just kept on trudging after the Jennifer Flowers story, after the draft story, the letter to Colonel Holmes, and he never seemed to be fazed by it.
Yeah, I don't know. Of course, as you know, as a guy from Louisiana, that was in the middle of the Gary Hart scandal. Billy Broadhurst.
Yes, indeed. Appropriately.
I don't know. I mean, the circumstances, I think, of surrounding him were a little bit different, but it never crossed my mind, and I'm pretty sure it never crossed President Clinton's mind at any point that we were ever going to go away. It just was not much of an issue inside the campaign, figuring out how to deal with things, but that wasn't part of the thought process.
When Bill Clinton announced in October of 91, he was just a few months removed from George Bush being the conquering hero in the Persian Gulf War, and polls showing him at 80 or 90%. That's why a lot of prominent candidates stayed away, but he dove in, and as it turned out, the economy went south, and it worked out well for the future president, Bill Clinton. But at that point, when he announced in October of 1991, I don't think many people were giving him much of a shot.
Right. Well, I was running a U.S. Senate campaign in Pennsylvania, an off-year election for the seat of Senator John Hines, who was tragically killed in an airplane accident. So, and my candidate was like 40 points down. So I was kind of focused on other things. Of course, I obviously was keeping an eye on the presidential race, but I didn't really start thinking about it until after November of 91, and I went to work for President Clinton on December the 1st of 1991.
How did you get the gig?
Well, you know, Jim, it's kind of hard. At that time, I had won a bunch of different races, and he was in Georgia at the governor's mansion talking to Governor Zell Miller, who I had run his campaign in 1990, a year before. And after the Wofford win, you know, all the candidates were calling, and so they called him to go to the mansion. I set up and went to talk to him, and it was clear from the get-go that this guy was, I mean, it's been like the first time that somebody saw Babe Ruth play baseball or something, like, holy moly, man, this guy is really good.
It was David Marinus who called him the natural.
Right. I mean, he's a once in a generation, once in a half century kind of politician.
I'm not sure that there's been one to equal him as a politician in his generation.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, and just his skill set and his ability to identify with people and also just ability to grasp issues, I've never really seen anybody close to him, and that's an assessment of a lot of other people, some who probably don't feel as kindly toward him as I do.
Well, he had a record as president. I remember your colleague Paul Begala saying, "What did you not like, the peace or the prosperity?" It was a good record, but of course it was also flawed by the Lewinsky scandal. On the whole, when we look back now, what do you think?
Well, name me one facet of American life that wasn't better in the year 2000 than it was in 1992. I mean, from the economy to the deficit to the crime rate to just about anything that you can think of. And I think by that standard, you think of the things that were done. And, you know, it's pretty remarkable to think, you know, we had balanced budgets. They came in when President Bush came into office. They, you know, supposedly they were worried about what we were going to do with the surpluses.
Yeah.
What a nice problem to have.
Yeah, we don't have that problem any longer. And the deficit had been the big issue for Ross Perot, who got 19% of the votes in 1992 on election night. And there is this enduring theory by some that Perot cost Bush the election, but exit polls really didn't show that, did they?
Right. It's an enduring theory, but everybody that's studied the returns, I mean, that is one of the most studied phenomena in political science. And, you know, it's been 25 years. And I'm just not worth it. I mean, debunked it so many times, it's been debunked by so many people. But, you know, they have people out there that think global warming is a Chinese hoax. So they're just going to have to go on thinking that, I guess. You know, Max Planck, the great theoretical physicist, said, science does not triumph because science convinces its opponents. Science triumphs because its opponents eventually die. Science advances one funeral at a time. I mean, there's people out there, that don't pay attention to observed phenomena. To that, I can't. I used to argue and get angry about it. Now I don't.
Well, when you were directing his campaign, you were holed up in a small office in downtown Little Rock. George Stephanopoulos was with you, and of course that prompted the moniker "The War Room." How was it in those early days of the campaign for president?
Well, I did things differently. I never had an office when I ran a campaign because they just encouraged meetings. So we were in like a big room. I was, and at a table, and we would, you know, pretty much routine. We'd get in at like 6 o'clock in the morning and go over to overnight polls. And back then we used to have a pouch. We'd bring all the newspapers in from Washington. You didn't have an internet.
That's
kind of
right.
Weird to think of that. Or somebody would back some of the stories to us. And it was very, I mean, the relationships, there was a story some time ago, and it's still true. There are probably six or seven of us that still talk four or five times a week. I mean, the thing about political campaigns, and this one in particular, is that the relationships have endured for 25 years. And I guarantee you, Paul, Mandy, George Stephanopoulos, Rahm Emanuel, I mean, people like that, we talk all the time, and we do things together, and, you know, we just all remain very, very tight over a period, Stan Greenberg, over a long period of time.
Bill Clinton sure hired some good people.
He did, and I think, you know, people like, I mean, he's just a remarkable man. I mean, his charm, the way he embraced people. He gave my daughter, Maddie, told him that she really liked the Beatles when she was young, and he had the most extensive Beatle collection I've ever seen. They had the original White Album. And we get a FedEx package one day, just giving the whole thing to her. I think sitting in a safe deposit box somewhere right now.
James Carville will speak some more in a few moments. We'll talk with a man from Louisiana who will soon be at LSU about his new assignment at Louisiana State University at the Manship School of Mass Communication. James Carville will also remember some more that night of November 3rd, 1992. Bill Clinton, less than 13 months after announcing his candidacy for president as a relatively unknown governor from Arkansas, ended up becoming the leader of the free world, an improbable campaign unseating a sitting United States president. And since 1960, the presidents elected from the Democratic view are all Southern Democrats. We'll talk more with James Carville after this time out on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana. James Carville is joining us from New York, where he is doing business, and he soon will be at Louisiana State University. We'll talk with him about that as well, his alma mater. And, oh, by the way, LSU plays Alabama tomorrow. But, James Carville, before we suspend discussion about the 1992 campaign for president, and today is the anniversary, 25 years ago tonight, the president won, Bill Clinton. You had this, I think it was remarkable, the personal chemistry you had. It's rare that you have a political consultant and a candidate who seem to be on the same wavelength in every way.
Yeah, President Clinton said one time that he thought that he and I were born in the same womb. I mean, we're similar ages. We were, you know, both Southern Democrats. We both, our ideology was largely shaped by the Civil Rights Movement. He was just a lot smarter than I was, but it's okay, too. He's a lot smarter than a lot of other people. And, you know, we're having our 25th anniversary in a couple of weeks in Little Rock, and, you know, everybody looks forward to that kind of thing and, you know, see how old everybody's gotten and how everybody's kids are doing and all that. My children actually enjoy that. They're looking forward to doing it because they, you know, there's a lot of the young people there, so it makes for a good get together. But yeah, you're right. There's very few people that you come across in life that you sort of the same age as you, the same kind of understanding of the world that you have. You know, by and large, forged by many of the same issues that you are. So there's a remarkable man and been a remarkable friend to me and my family for a long time.
And your girlfriend at that time, who's been your wife now, I think, of 22 or 23 years, was Mary Madeline?
I think it's going to be 24 Thanksgiving.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
She was running the Bush campaign.
Yeah, we had met before. We had met January the 8th, 1991. And that's when, you know, President Bush and that been in March, I guess it was, during the first Gulf War, which he pursued very successfully, was really popular. And, you know, we were dating, and then in May of 1991, I had to move to Philadelphia to go run Senator Wofford's campaign. So she would come up there and meet me quite a bit. And then we got married in November, Thanksgiving Day, 1993, in New Orleans at her insistence.
Well, 91 was a big year for you. You met your wife on January 8th?
Yeah, I guess it was, yeah. And that was that Wofford race. Was the kind of...
Oh, yeah, that was the turning
point. That's kind of... I always tell people, I tell my students, you know, I was 48 before I was James Carville. I had spent a long time as some, you know, as somebody else.
But you went to work for Bill Clinton December 1, 91. Do you recall the first time you met him?
Yeah, the first time I met him just briefly was at an event. I was managing a Senate campaign in New Jersey in 88, and he came to speak at the dinner, but I just talked to him briefly. But I sat down with him in the lobby of a hotel in Washington, and I had met with Senator Kerry was running, Senator Hawken, probably forgetting somebody else back then, and it just was so clear that he was on a level or a plane that nobody else was on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just remarkably talented man.
Well, who could have written the script, though, that you're hired, he wins the election against all odds, then 8 years go by, and as you state, he inherited this enormous deficit at the time, historically high. He erases it. He leaves office extremely popular, but marred by the Lewinsky scandal. Gore loses a race that is unbelievable in that he lost essentially by 537 votes in Florida. And then Hillary Clinton becomes a U.S. senator. She becomes Secretary of State, and she almost wins the presidency in 2016 and loses to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
If you had written that as what would happen, people would when you left the White House, people would have said you were crazy.
Yeah, a bit like the Sports Illustrated that put the cover in 2014 said the Astros will be to win a World Series in 2017. But those are kind of rare events that something like that happens. You know, the thing about politics, now I've done 22 different countries. So, I mean, I think I've worked for 14 different heads of states in my career at one time or another. And, you know, sometimes you think you know a lot and you find out you don't know very much. It's a kind of a humbling, it's a humbling enterprise sometimes. It really can be. And I try to, and I'm enjoying this phase of my life where I'm spending my time around young people and teaching and very excited about coming to Baton Rouge a couple of days a week and actually get a chance to see my daughter. My daughter's a sophomore at LSU, and she was at boarding school in Virginia. I saw her more often than I see her now.
That's wonderful.
She'll have a lot of time for me.
That'll be in the spring.
Yeah, I start in the spring. I've been 9 years at Tulane. It's a very rewarding experience there, but is LeBron... As I might say, I'm taking my talents to Baton Rouge.
you're a free agent. Well, I know the Manship School's excited to have you. John Breaux's been teaching out there this semester.
He has, and it's a really good it's a good idea. The people there I really like, the faculty I like the culture they have around there, and it's actually, you know, a school of mass communication. So I've got, you know, I'll have young people that are interested in communicating, and mm-hmm. we're going to do some interesting things, going to try to have some interesting programs on campus. One of the things we're talking about is Professor Mann wrote a piece, Should Young People in Louisiana Stay or Go? And I think we're going to need to have a forum on that because we got a multitude of problems in our state, and, you know, if policymakers don't want to get serious about them, I can't tell young people they should stay. Now, if they want to get serious, you know, particularly the coast, but look at the library at LSU. I mean, there are a lot of things that there's a lot of work we need to do here, and I'm not getting any younger, so I got to get started on it pretty fast.
Well, there you go. Well, we're great. It's going to be great to have you back. And oh, by the way, LSU plays Alabama tomorrow in Tuscaloosa.
Boy. Oh God, I'm throwing up already. I got to go to an event for a friend of mine having some big party. So you better have a television there.
Losing Nick Saban was a blow, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I liked Coach Saban. People, you know, I had limited dealings with him, but, you know, I thought he's a great coach. But, you know, let's see, Coach O. I have this sneaking suspicion that we're going to do pretty well Saturday night. I really do. I mean, I'm a little bit of a Pollyanna, I admit that. But I think Coach O's going to have those guys ready to play. And, you know, I went to the game last year, and so the fourth quarter, we brought them to a standstill. I think our players mentally mm-hmm. believe they can beat this team. And when you think you can do something, by and large, you know, sometimes you actually do it.
Right.
So I'm not ready to throw the towel in yet, I guarantee you that. I don't think the coaching staff or the football players are either. I think they're ready to roll.
Well, lastly, James, the Cliff Notes version, what do you think of President Trump?
Less than you would think I would think of him.
Less?
Less, and if you thought I didn't think very much of him, you'd be correct. I mean, I've just never seen anything like it. Someone so contemptuous of public policy, of personnel decisions, of anything you can imagine. But he's the president, so we'll see how long that lasts.
And we thank James Carville for joining us from New York City, where he is doing business. He's still going strong at the age of 73. Hard to believe. He's 73. He mentioned he was 48 in 1992 when Bill Clinton won the election on this date, November 3rd. Clinton was 46 years old, one of the youngest presidents in United States history. He'd been governor of Arkansas for 12 years. But when he entered the race in 91 in October, not many people thought Bill Clinton would unseat George Herbert Walker Bush. You would have gotten a lot of money if you had bet on Bill Clinton at that time. And perhaps his most fateful decision was hiring James Carville December 1, 1991. And those two were quite a tandem. And Bill Clinton went on to win both Louisiana and Arkansas and several other southern states, the last Democrat to do that, last Democrat to win in Louisiana, and he did so twice in 92 and in 96. We'll remember that campaign a bit more, and also hear an interview conducted with Leo Honeycutt and Skip Bertman with none other than Nick Saban, the LSU tormentor. Alabama hosts LSU tomorrow. Now the news with Karen Henderson. This is Jim Inkster, and we're pleased to have as our guest at this time Steve Cochran, the director of the Restore the Mississippi Delta Coalition. For 2.5 years, he's held this post after a career that has spanned many decades involved in making the environment a better place. And in Louisiana, as we know, we have a number of challenges, some that are imminent, and Steve Cochran is on the front lines of addressing those challenges. And a few days ago, there was a new plan that was unveiled, that involves how we're going to restore the natural functioning of the Mississippi River Delta. What's going on, Steve Cochran?
Well, as I think your listeners know, and you certainly do, we've got a significant challenge with our coastline. We've lost a couple of thousand square miles, literally, over the last 80 years or so. And without action, we would lose maybe another 3,000 or 4,000 square miles. In other words, we would pretty much lose everything along the coast if we didn't take some of the actions that we're now taking. So the goal here is to make sure that we can get projects on the ground in place that can help really lock in our coastline, protect us from the storms that we get, and make sure that we have the world-class habitat that we have in place. So as the state has moved forward on that mission, they have a process of creating a master plan every 5 years, which takes the latest science, the latest information, the best knowledge that we have, puts it together, prioritizes the work. But as you can imagine, going all the way across the coast, you end up with more than 100 projects in the plan, which is important, and that plan spreads out over 50 years. So it's an all-encompassing thing. What we wanted to do was to look at the plan and look at where we are right now and think about those projects which together could provide the best progress at the fastest level, the most efficient way, so that we were encouraging the dedication of resources, both people to manage it and money to do the projects, that we could really help focus that, prioritize that, and really make sure that the sense of urgency, I think, that many of us feel about the need to get these projects done and in place is really expanded and really brought to bear on getting this work done.
Well, this new master plan that was unveiled on the 15th, as a few days ago, are you encouraged by it?
Well, so I think we may have confused you a little bit here. The Coastal Master Plan was actually passed in the legislature
right
in June, and then what we've done is to really look at, so there are, in that master plan, there are 79 projects which are focused on restoration. What we did was to comb through those projects, look at which projects could really work together of the largest scale, could really help restore our the function of these ecosystems so they could maintain themselves and really could be implementable in the next 3 to 5 years. We sort of used those criteria looking through the projects, and where we ended up was on a focused list of 17 projects, really just trying to make sure that we get the very best work in the very shortest period of time on the most important projects, and that's the 17 projects. We call it a priority projects report, but that's what we put out earlier in the week.
All right, and the 79 that you mentioned, that means there are 62 that are not priority projects. What happens to them?
Well, there are two things. One is Those 62 are spread out over time. The plan that the state put together spreads out over 50 years. So a lot of those projects are in the later years. The other thing is that all those projects are really priorities from a broad perspective. It's important for us to do all the work that we need to protect ourselves down here. But you can't do everything at once, and you don't have all the money in place. You don't have $50 billion or $100 billion mm-hmm. laying around, and you don't have, frankly, even enough engineering firms to go out and do all that work in 3 to 5 years. It'd be nice if we could do that, right. but that's not reality. What reality is we have a certain amount of capacity, a certain amount of money, and we need to make sure that we do the very best with that in the shortest period of time. So those 62 remaining projects are still important. They're still going to go forward over time. We're really focused on right here, right now. Let's get this done.
We're visiting with Steve Cochran, director of the Restore the Mississippi Delta Coalition. Steve, you've been doing this a long time, former chief of staff for Governor Buddy Romer, and the 17 priority projects, they're the best of the best recommendations. What is it about them that makes them the most noteworthy and the most imminent as far as addressing?
Yeah, we really, one of the things that we really focus on is how do we help the system that we have down here, the wetlands and the marshes and the barrier islands and all those things. How do we help them, for lack of a better way to put it, how do we help them help themselves? And by the way you do that is by trying to restore the natural systems the way they are. So part of that here is really using the rivers that we have down here. The rivers brought the sediment down here and spread it out across the land in the first place. That's how we actually have this delta, how we built this land down here. And what we're trying to do is to help redo that so that we can re-engage the river, the sediment in the river, that's the Chafalaya River and the Mississippi River, really let it do what it could do. Because if you do that, you not only can rebuild land, but you can sustain it. And that's the key down here. We don't need to just go build a marsh creation project and pump a bunch of sediment into a place and pile it up, and it'll be there for 20 or 30 years. But as soon as you turn that dredge off, that land starts sinking, because that's what our land does down here. If, though, you build that marsh creation project, let's say you got 100 acres of marsh that you build, and you connect that up with a sediment diversion that's going to bring new sediment and new fresh water out of the river and into that area, you can continue to sustain that land once you rebuilt it. So what we did was to look at how those things work together. How do we re-engage the natural system? And then how do we take advantage of the synergies among these projects so that we can get really the very best work in the shortest period of time?
Well, the BP money the state received, is that a help in the money that is necessary to make these projects work?
Well, we got lucky for all the wrong reasons, and people were sacrificed over this. So there's some sense, I think, that we should have of a moral obligation to the sacrifices that occurred to try to make sure that we use this money. Now, the opportunity that we have is remarkable, because it's one thing to have a plan and not have any resources to do it. We're sort of experienced with that if you work around government for very long. Lots of ideas, but not enough resources. And in this case, we have a world-class plan with serious science behind it, and we have the resources to make a huge more than one first step, a number of steps. We'll have more than $500 million every single year for the next 15 years to be doing this work. And what it's up to us is to take full advantage of that, because the idea that this will somehow happen again, that we'll somehow have a lot more money that'll just show up, that's just not the way the world works. So we need to take full advantage. We have the opportunity to do it. That's really rare in this kind of work. We have that opportunity now in Louisiana, and so we have to take advantage of it.
Well, in singling out these 17 priority projects, the best of the best recommendations from the master plan, does that change the estimated cost of what is needed to address this, or is that about the same as it was?
I don't know that it'll change the cost. One of the things, though, that we do know is that we've actually looked at this. Let's say you have a project that you were planning on building in 10 years. If you can build that project today, it's going to be cheaper to build it today on inflation and other costs that occur. So, and you obviously get the protections associated with that new project if you get it in place. So there's every reason to try to move projects up in the system. Two limits on that are being able to use the money. Let's say you know you're going to get money in the 15th year, $500 million is sitting out there, but you can't get it until then. What the state is looking at, what we're looking at, are ways to help bond that money, to other ways to move that money forward so that you could build a project now rather than wait 10 years, you know, to get that money. So that's one possibility to take advantage of. The other is capacity. You have to have the people in place to manage the work. And I think that's something that now that this money is starting to flow, we're really going to figure out how, what's the right capacity at the Coastal Protection and Resources Authority, the other parts of state government that are involved here. Do we have the right people in the right places at the right time to make this work? So far, the answer to that has largely been yes. But we're now really coming into the opportunity to really put these resources to work. And so we'll need to be clear about that.
What's the next step?
Well, I think, you know, these projects are in the master plan. Many of them are already beginning on their engineering and design work. You know, these are big projects. These things take some time. And so the next step is really just complete and total focus on getting these jobs done, moving forward, making sure that the state has the resources that it needs, making sure that inertia, slowdowns, things like that don't infect this work that needs to be done. So we'll be paying attention to that. We'll be encouraging. We'll be helping everywhere we can. We'll be educating as much as possible. And that's really where we have to go, though. We have to get this work done, and really nothing needs to stop us at this stage.
Steve, if we as a people did nothing, what would happen?
We would lose somewhere around 3,000 to 4,000 more square miles, which means that if you look along the coast, you look at Calcasieu Parish, you look at Vermilion Parish, you look at Terrebonne and Lafourche and St. Mary and coming across to where we are over here in Plaquemines and Jefferson and St. Bernard, all those parishes are at great risk if we don't do anything. They just simply can't sustain themselves because we've cut off the basic natural systems that helped sustain them in the first place. So if we don't do these things, we literally have to move from anywhere that we live in the southern part of the state. And that's a big undertaking. But we don't have to do that if we can do the work that we know will work. But we have to go. We have to be serious about getting that work done.
Well, thanks for joining us. It's always good to get your insights and updates. Steve Cochran, Director of Restore the Mississippi Delta Coalition. Steve, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana. And in our last segment today, we'll talk with Kyle DeCoyan. He's from PEN America, a media watchdog group. And PEN America is involved in addressing the challenges that media practitioners face not only in the United States but around the world. It's an interesting time with the media and governments often at odds, including the United States. And we'll visit with Kyle DeCoyan about a most interesting development that's occurred in the last year under the presidency of Donald Trump. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And now our guest is a young man, Kyle DeCoyan. He is affiliated with PEN International, Senior Manager of Literary Outreach and Activism. And PEN International, for those unfamiliar, is a media advocacy group, and it is the largest of its kind in the United States. Before we get started on what you're involved with here in Louisiana and elsewhere, Kyle, what about the work of PEN International? How significant is it in this country?
I think it's crucial now more than ever. PEN works with writers and media makers of all kinds, but the work that we've been really focused on over the last year are the ways in which false narratives and misinformation are proliferating and dividing communities in different ways. And so we're thinking about what writers in particular can do to intervene in that and to facilitate discourse across difference.
Kyle is based in New York City. He's a graduate of Brown University, the alma mater of our former governor, Bobby Jindal. But this media frenzy that's going on right now with many saying that stories are illegitimate, that they're fake, some are and some are not. But sometimes those that are legitimate are accused of being fraudulent. How do we get to the point where we can discern what is true and what is not?
I think that we have to be building up more knowledge among broader groups of the community around news literacy and fact-checking and how that actually works and how news production actually works. I think there's a misunderstanding of what goes into story development and what kinds of different sources mm-hmm. a reader might go to sort of discern what's true and what's false.
Well, what are some of the telltale signs when a story has problems?
I think one of the first things folks can go to is just numbers. Verifying, voter participation, money that's spent on crisis management, quantifying resources that are mm-hmm. provided. These are things that folks can do to sort of curb outright false narratives. Another thing is just going back to records, going back to previously reported statements, obtaining records that are available through the Freedom of Information Act. I think that's something that not a lot of folks are aware is a resource that's available to them.
Mm-hmm. Now, recently there's a story about Judge Roy Moore in Alabama. Now, when I read it, I immediately saw that it emanated from the Washington Post, so it made me realize that it was a legitimate story. It may have issues of validity or not, but it comes from the Washington Post. But if I had not seen the Washington Post, I would have thought that was a fake news story, because I've followed Judge Moore for a long time, and he may be a lot of things, but I did not think he would be involved in something like he's being accused of. So how do we get to the point where we're careful enough to not only analyze the information, but to take into account where it's coming from?
I think that the Washington Post report of the Roy Moore news is a really great example of transparency in the reporting, so that the reader can determine for themselves whether they feel this is a true story or not. And so, something that demonstrates validity in that reporting is the extent to which the reporter cross-checked, different friends who verified the story being shared several decades ago, cross-checking one of the accuser's mothers. There's kind of a depth of information that this isn't originating from one particular source.
Steve Bannon, the former advisor to the president, who still is a fan of President Trump, was quick to say that he thought the Washington Post was in concert with enemies of the president and of Roy Moore. Is that becoming more common than not, that when a story is out there that we don't like, we attack the messenger?
I think that folks are looking at media in really hyper-politicized ways right now. What we're trying to emphasize in our work at PEN America is that facts and truth are apolitical. Fact-checking mm-hmm. should be an apolitical exercise, even if we don't necessarily believe that the media always is.
Well, we're visiting with Kyle, give me a pronunciation.
It's DeKoyan.
DeKoyan, mm-hmm. Kyle DeKoyan, who is affiliated with the PEN American Center in New York City as the Director of Literary Outreach and Activism. And this organization is no Johnny-come-lately. PEN International, PEN American, these organizations have been around for a long time, haven't they?
That's right. PEN America has been around since, I think, 1922. It was originally a core of writers working to kind of facilitate cultural exchange across borders.
And how important is that work now? Is it more important now than ever before?
I absolutely think that keeping cultural exchange open is something that's really important, especially now as we see so much rampant xenophobia, distrust of people from other cultures and other experiences. I think that, making sure that we continue to facilitate the flow of culture and information across borders, it's critical work.
Mm-hmm. Kyle DeKoyan, what about those who say the media are congregated principally in New York, where you are and where most of the gatekeepers are, by people left of center? Is that valid?
I think that it's valid to say that there is a density of media that's produced in New York, DC, and so on. But actually, something that we're emphasizing in our work is the importance of local media in providing a critical check on, you know, on that particular bent. And a lot of local media makers have been really under the pinch over the last decade. So we're thinking of what we can do to build readership and audience for those publications and content streams.
And you're working in Louisiana to facilitate
we're
that.
We're just building up groundwork in Louisiana to do that. So we're getting out and meeting local writers, local mm-hmm. advocacy groups, neighborhood associations, faith-based organizations, and thinking about how we can really approach this in a way that emphasizes diversity of perspective and is inclusive in all ways.
Because of consolidation and because of newspapers going by the wayside in many places across the country, some in Louisiana, there aren't as many media watchdogs as there used to be, and there aren't as many media practitioners. This has got to be an issue. When I remember when I first started covering the state capitol, there would be 20 people around the governor, and now there are probably only a few. Two or three who cover the governor every step of the way.
We're seeing a lot of local newspapers like the Times-Picayune kind of decreasing staff capacity, but at the same time, we're also seeing a lot of former reporters from different publications like that forming their own media sources. You have the Lens, Gambit in New Orleans. I think... preserving a diverse media landscape is one way that you can kind of fill the gap mm-hmm. of the absence of a local media watchdog.
Now, Gambit has done well through the years, but these others have had difficulty. And if you're not paying the bills, it's hard to keep on going. So how challenging is it for media sources to have the sustenance they need to keep on reporting?
It's incredibly challenging, especially when you consider that a lot of these outlets are already operating on a pretty shoestring budget. Reporters are really kind of working past the capacity of the organization. So that's why I think the really critical step right now is building readership, building audience, because mm-hmm. that's the only way to sustain revenue for organizations and publications like this.
Now, this show airs on a national public radio station in Baton Rouge, and the NPR Morning Show, Morning Edition, has probably well over 20 million people listening on a weekly basis. Morning Joe, a show the president watches and often attacks, has about 500,000 viewers in a given show. So many more people listen to the radio, national public radio in particular, than watch these cable news shows. But it seems these cable shows, like Morning Joe, seem to often guide the news cycle. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't know that I fall on a sort of evaluative stance there. I think it's just a condition that we have to consider. And I think it's because we're a really visually driven culture. And I think that television is one way in particular that that our notions of truth and fact can be manipulated mm-hmm. Through visual representation.
Well, we thank you for joining us, Kyle DeKoyan. He is Senior Manager of Literary Outreach and Activism of PEN America in New York City. On Broadway Suite. So we thank you for coming to Baton Rouge today and visit with us.
Thanks, Jim.
Take care. We're back after this pause on WRKF.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.